Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. Hanging tight after a fine show of Homegrown. This is a Sunday morning wake-up call. I am Rick Moore with our guest today, Larry Gerritsen, Director of Communications from the Virginia Institute of Autism right here in Charlottesville. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me in.
Well, important topics need important people to visit us. So glad to have you. You know, people often know about autism strictly through stereotypes of movies and television. And so I was hoping that our conversation today could spread the word in a little better light. And I thought maybe you were the man to do that. If we brought in someone from the Virginia Institute of Autism, we could get a little more realistic conversation going.
Well, I'm happy to take a stab at it. I'm spreading awareness about autism, and part of that spreading awareness is obviously kind of working against stereotypes, trying to counter stereotypes, is one of the things that we are in the mission of doing. So I'm happy to have an opportunity to talk about it with you.
Well, let's start by talking about the stereotype versus the reality. So autism, and I think many people, many listeners, are aware of the stereotype, which is whether it's the child to the adult of hands over their ears, being unable to carry on the conversation and unable to handle the situation that they're in. So let's start with what is autism, what brings it on, and then let's have you take the stereotype and put it right.
Yeah, well, so autism is a neurological condition, disorder. And it affects, we talk about it as a spectrum disorder, which just means that there is a very wide variety of symptoms and effects and probably of underlying causes as well for autism. So that when we talk about the autism spectrum, we're talking about everyone from a very highly functioning young adult who has a certain degree of neurologically constrained social difficulties, social challenges, inability to read social situations, but is otherwise perfectly capable of communicating, functioning, holding a job. That's one end of the kind of milder end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum are individuals kind of like you described the stereotype applying to, for whom sensory input is severely garbled. They will be overwhelmed by loud noises, unable to hold together their behavior, dive into tantrums, repetitive motion as a way of stimulating and calming themselves in that sensory welter that they experience in the world. And those individuals at the most challenged end of the spectrum can have extremely severe sets of symptoms. 30% of people with autism have no spoken language whatsoever. That comes with severe behavioral challenges like the tantrums I just talked about. Those individuals, it takes a huge effort to teach them the basics of self-care, toileting, dressing, eating even. So autism is a spectrum disorder. Broad spectrum of abilities and disabilities. Even just within individual symptoms like communication issues, There's a huge spectrum there. Some individuals with autism have no spoken communication, like I say. Some individuals with autism, very highly intelligent and very highly functioning, are hyperlexic, kind of manic in their verbal behaviors. So, you know, part of the history of autism is coming to terms with, scientifically coming to terms with how such a huge, complex set of symptoms kind of can fit under one umbrella. And then we as a society have that challenge, too, of how do we fit them under one umbrella. Stereotypes are one of the ways, right? So the thing to say about stereotypes is that stereotypes come from somewhere. And I'm maybe the kind of the stereotype of a person with autism, or the social, you know, the common social touchstone that people have of the individual with autism is the movie Rain Man, Dustin Hoffman's character. There's someone who's obsessive, avoidant of eye contact, runs in those obsessions in very narrow channels, but is kind of a savant in certain things, is card counting and number counting and things like that. So the way to counter the stereotype is to say that the stereotype is true in only a limited sense, right? That there's a much broader spectrum of behaviors and challenges that exists on the autism spectrum. And then the other way to counter it is to humanize it, right? I mean, the idea of a stereotype is that it reduces a complex individual to just one thing, and people with autism are more than their autism. So one of our functions at the Virginia Institute of Autism is to engage people with community, society, with their families, and to kind of broaden the world's experience of people with autism. We want to give people with autism a broader experience and ability to function in the world, but we also want to give the world a broader experience of people with autism. So that's kind of a nutshell on the diagnosis and history.
We are talking with Larry Gerritsen here about autism. He's from the Virginia Institute of Autism, and I'm going to misspeak and say some incorrect things throughout the hour. I hope you use me as the touchstone to teach people today. It's not my specialty topic. I don't have anyone in my immediate family who is autistic. So please feel free to correct me and as you're correcting other listeners throughout the hour. But you talk about a wide spectrum. A question is, are we increasing the number of individuals with autism by increasing the spectrum? Should there be a different, is the word disease?
Disorder.
Disorder.
Yeah.
By not changing the word autism? I'm wondering if the... if we keep increasing the spectrum, if the spectrum is so wide that we have such a large number of people with a disorder, should it be different disorders?
Yeah, that's a kind of a medical philosophical question that I can't really answer from a medical standpoint. But what I would say is that... our increasing understanding of autism and the spectrum of disorders that it embodies has a benefit, and that is that we can develop treatment models that work for all of these people. So I would say that if it were true that we were trying to do a one-size-fits-all sort of treatment for all of them, then I would say maybe it wouldn't make sense to broaden the spectrum. But the truth about it, and the truth about treatment, is just kind of exactly the opposite of that. That even in spite of the fact that we are kind of categorizing this broad spectrum of symptoms as a single disorder, autism, that hasn't stopped us from delivering to kids who have communication challenges exactly the communication services, communication teaching that they need to do better. That hasn't stopped us from delivering to kids who have social challenges exactly the kinds of social teaching that they need. Just to give you a sense of how we approach service delivery at the Virginia Institute of Autism, we hire a really broad spectrum of specialists to our spectrum of specialists is as broad as the spectrum that we seek to serve, right? So we have speech-language pathologists. We have social workers. We have special education teachers who have education backgrounds. We have occupational therapists, physical therapists that we bring to bear on this disorder. And so the mix of what the right treatment methods are for any individual varies from individual to individual, just as the symptoms vary. So I would say that I don't see a lot of value in dividing up the diagnosis, because we're doing such a great job of particularizing the services that we deliver to the people who need them. So
let's talk for a minute about the number of individuals who have the disorder. Can you share that information with us?
Yeah, so this is a huge issue for us as a society right now. I think part of the reason we want to be out having conversations like this, doing outreach and information conversations like this, is autism is increasingly something that I think everyone in the community has some sort of contact with. Even if there's not somebody in your immediate family who's on the spectrum, at this point you probably know someone who is. And that's because the diagnosis of autism has increased hugely over the last 20 years. VIA was founded in 1996. So we're on
the Virginia Institute of Autism.
We go by the acronym VIA. Founded in 1996. And back then, the estimate was that one out of every 250 or so individuals was on the autism spectrum. The Centers for Disease Control recently, every 2 years, they do an evaluation by putting out a big study that studies what the incidence of autism is. Their most recent number is one out of every 59. So basically, our sense now is that 10 times more people have autism than we thought 20 years ago. And there are a number of reasons for that. But I think the primary reason is that we understand the disorder better. And that's a good news, bad news kind of story, right? As we understand the disorder better, we know better how to treat it, and we also know better how to diagnose it. And what you're seeing in that rate of increase of incidence of autism is the increase in our ability to diagnose. The good news is that along with that has come an increase in our ability to actually treat the disorder as well. So there's an upside. So what does that mean? So one in 59. Autism is not a reportable statistic, so we don't keep an exact count, like a census, of people with autism. What the Centers for Disease Control does every couple of years is they go out and they survey rates of diagnosis, rates of people who are receiving treatment for autism, and they put together a model that tells them approximately how many individuals in the age range from 8 to 10 have the disorder. So what we have is an incidence. And if that incidence of 1 in 59 holds true all the way across the age groups, what that means is about 1.7% of the U.S. population has autism. And that amounts to 5.5 million people. Here in the state of Virginia, that's 127,000 people. So, I did recently a quick count of what that would mean in Charlottesville and Alamo County, about 2,250. People just within our county boundaries here on the autism spectrum. What we know is only a few hundred of those are receiving services. So there's a huge services gap that goes along with this increase in diagnosis. And one of the things that VIA, Virginia Institute of Autism, is focusing on is increasing our service delivery so that we can meet the needs of more people. But there are challenges that come with that as well. So.
When you talk about that number, and I didn't write it down because it caught me off guard. The several 2,000 here
probably
in Charlottesville, Albemarle.
Yeah, if the incidence rate holds true for Charlottesville and Albemarle,
right,
based on the population,
if it's equally distributed
across
the state,
then it's about 2,250 people within Charlottesville and Albemarle on the autism spectrum.
And you're saying that VIA is servicing 200.
We reach about 200 individuals. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So there are 2,000, just about 2,000 who are not receiving services. And some of that could be by choice.
Mm-hmm.
But the family is trying to do something on their own, or feeling forced to do something on their own. Is that because of expense? Is that because of throwing your hands up in the air? Is that because this particular individual is at the high-functioning end of the spectrum?
Yeah, I think probably something like all of that. It comes into play. Unfortunately, it's not easy to be able to characterize an underserved, an unserved population. But just to go back just for a second, Rick. So, VIA serves a couple of hundred people, but there are other service providers, right? So, and actually our local school districts do a great job of serving kids with autism who are in school age. So I think there's a couple of hundred between Charlottesville City Schools and Albemarle County Schools who are getting services directly through the schools as well. There are other service providers who provide outpatient services in the region. There are local community service boards that have programs that provide services to people. So, it's a challenge because the terrain of service of provisions is sort of all over the place. And again, there's nobody collecting, doing the census, doing the actual head count.
HIPAA plays a role too.
And yeah, that's right.
You can't share the medical information.
Yeah, there are privacy issues that play into our lack of knowledge about the underserved as well, or the served as well. But our friends at the UVA Curry School of Education Foundation. Curry School has great programs in training people in special education, and particularly in autism. They got some great faculty members there who we do some partnering with who do that. They've done some counting, and it's according to them, they think that kind of statewide, the number of people who are not receiving any kind of autism services at all is close to around 50%. When you add up all the service providers, all the possibilities of, you know, small-scale and large-scale services, something like 50%. So, again, we're guessing. It's an estimate. But I think we're in the range of maybe 1,000 people rather than 2,000 in Charlottesville and Albemarle who might not be getting services. So, yeah, and the question is why, and what's the characteristics of those people? I think some of them could be very high-functioning and just have never been diagnosed. I think some of them could have thrown up their hands. I think some of them are on wait lists for providing services. We know that those are out there, and that services, particularly the state funding of services for adults, are have extensive wait lists. We have people waitlisted at VIA as well for our services. So, there are a lot of folks out there who are in need.
We are talking about autism. With Larry Gerritsen from Virginia Institute of Autism. Larry, we were talking about numbers, the increasing number from 1 in 250
20 years ago.
To 1 in 59 in the last 2 years, the most recent CDC. But it's not just the general population, I believe. There's also, I guess that used to be, or in the past, the autism spectrum used to be strictly or mostly white, Caucasian individuals, and now those numbers are increasing in Hispanic and African Americans, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's pretty easy to imagine the challenges of diagnosis and sort of delivery of the kind of medical services to some communities. It's easier among the white middle class to get a count than it is among a traditionally underserved demographic. But we're getting better at that. So again, it's the increasing incidence among African Americans and Hispanic populations in particular is, again, one of these good news, bad news kinds of things. What it means is that we're getting to those populations better, and we're evaluating the need better, and we're doing a better job of diagnosis than we used to, too. And, you know, one of the things we talk about, I meant to mention before, when we talk about getting better at diagnosis, it used to be, and people are kind of alarmed sometimes when they think about, when we talk about the increase in numbers, this is just this huge demographic wave that's happening. Where is it coming from? Is there something in the environment? Is there something, and it may be that there are environmental factors that are contributing to it, but by and large, this is an increase in our ability to diagnose, and it's a refined kind of set of categories for diagnosis as well. In the old days, 20 years ago, there was there was autism, and it was characterized kind of rigidly as kind of communication and social deficits. But there was this big kind of catch-all diagnosis that was referred to as PDD-NOS in the medical literature, pervasive developmental disorder - not otherwise specified. So that's a shrug, right? That's a we can't say what's the issue with this person who's showing symptoms. And a lot of what you see in the increase in diagnosis is an increasing ability to say that those people who were previously we just threw up our hands about, we're able to see that their symptoms, their challenges really do reside on this autism spectrum. So that's, again, one of those good story, good news, bad news kinds of things about diagnosis.
Yeah. All right, let's take our first break with Larry Gerritsen. He's the Director of Communications at the Virginia Institute of Autism. Hang tight. All right, we are back with Larry Gerritsen here. The hour is devoted to the conversation of autism. I want to make sure that everybody knows what is going on. And the stereotypes are shot down and the knowledge is pumped up. Larry, we touched on underserving so many of the folks, I guess just in the United States, but you made specific mention of the Charlottesville Albemarle area and how we had, if going by the numbers, just evenly distributed, there were about 2,250. But you said that, about 200 being served in the local schools, mm-hmm. In each Charlottesville and Albemarle. So, which got me to some questions, just the public school system in general. Mm. So, I'm curious as to how that works, how a student with autism somewhere on the spectrum works in a public school system. Mm. Because, and I'd like you to start with, I believe it's FAPE, F-A-P-E, mm. Free and Public Education.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that any student, even a student with autism, is given the chance to go to a public school.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me a little bit about a student with autism in a public school system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, 20 years ago, when VIA was first founded, we didn't know a whole lot about how to treat autism. It was only just starting to become widely known what techniques could work. And a little bit later in the hour, we can go into some detail about what those techniques are. It's really interesting how we provide education to individuals on the spectrum, any individual with a developmental disability. It's a really interesting interesting thing. It made sense then that we try to deliver services to individuals with developmental disabilities through the public schools. They already existed, and there is a mandate that public schools must serve every student. That's what, by definition, makes them public. In the 70s and 80s, there was a developing kind of legal framework that supported, reinforced, and really strengthened that commitment. The Americans with Disabilities Act and eventually the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, both of which dictated that no individual could be denied, not for any reason, and not for any developmental disability, a free and equal public education. So what that meant that schools had to get busy at being really good providers of special education services. And by and large, they did. It was a struggle, as you might imagine. It's a big kind of addition to the public school mission to say, we're not just going to do kind of SOL track, we're not just going to do kind of standard education track, we're also going to provide this track that has to be, you know, from what we were talking about earlier, you can understand how highly specialized, highly particularized the education of individuals on the spectrum has to be. So schools scrambled to do it, but by and large they have done it and done it pretty well. But it's a really severe, steep challenge to ask them to be able to serve every single individual on the spectrum. So the reason that VIA exists is that families, even as schools 20 years ago were working to build special education programs that could serve students, some families were finding it wasn't working for them. And you found quite frequently back then lawsuits against public schools that were devoted to parents saying, my child is not, you know, getting an education that will serve them. And places like VIA came into being so that we could be the specialist kind of frontline troops that would help with the most challenging cases. And if you think of it just in terms of cost benefit, is it right for our county schools to have to have to provide a free and public general education, and at the same time this free and public hyper-specialized, hyper-specialist intensive education for everyone? Or does it make more sense to have there be specialist schools, specialty schools, like the Virginia Institute of Autism? I think that division of labor has worked very well. We have right now 61 students from regional schools. And they tend, by and large, to be the students that the schools feel that they cannot best serve. And again, they're all across the spectrum. They come from also from all of the kind of geographical regions in Central Virginia, from deep rural over in the valley to, you know, Charlottesville and Albemarle. And that division of labor, specialty school and provision of special ed services in the public schools, has worked pretty well.
Is VIA state funded?
So VIA runs three main key programs, one of which is our James C. Hormel School, and that is where we serve the public school clientele. The other, which is our outpatient services, which does in-home work, out in the community work, and even does occasionally go into public schools and help their special education teachers run their programs in public schools. And then we have an adult services program as well. So each one of those programs is funded by separate kind of separate pools of dollars. So the school is funded by tuition that is paid from the individual students' local school district dollars, supplemented by a state fund that's funded through a state law called the Children's Services Act, so that the intensive services that we provide at the James C. Hormel School are funded both by the students' local school district dollars and the Children's Services Act.
But it's
together.
Not by the parent. It's not paid by the parent.
No.
So
this is a free,
right.
It's a free public education, quote unquote public education.
It's paid
at a specialty school
in
mm-hmm.
some way through the taxes.
That's right.
of people throughout the state.
Yeah.
But is it? Are the students at the James C. Hormel School at Virginia Institute of Autism? Those students are students that the parents have decided to send to VIA, not the public school system?
It is the public school system's decision. Often it's the parents urging the public school system. Sometimes it's the public school system itself coming to the conclusion that we think this student's going to be better served by coming to a specialty school like VIA. Yeah.
So does that mean that the students at the James E. Hormel School are typically at the lower end of the spectrum?
No, actually, we serve kids from all over. So, you know, when we serve a variety of school districts, right? So the ability of any individual school district changes from school district to school district. Albemarle and Charlottesville schools are very highly funded. They've got a really, you know, really top-notch special education programs there. Other kind of more rural schools tend to not be so well funded in special education. And so sometimes even a kid on the higher functioning end of the spectrum will be better served by an environment like VIA's. One of the ways that we talk about those kids on the higher functioning end of the spectrum is that their behaviors, their challenges can be what we talk about as low frequency, high intensity. Right. So one of the challenges of autism is behavioral challenges. And those behavioral challenges can lead to tantrums, can lead to lashing out physically. Those challenges can be true even for kids on the higher verbal functioning end of the spectrum. Right. So if a kid exhibits in a public school a tendency to lash out, a tendency to tantrum. Those are things that we are very well set up to deal with, but that a public school may not be so well set up to deal with. So that would be an instance of a kid who maybe by a lot of lights is pretty high functioning, may nonetheless have pretty severe behavioral challenges that need to be dealt with in a situation like ours.
My homework brought me to a word, and I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this properly, perseverate.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know that word. What is it?
A student with autism who focuses on something, if they get it in their mind.
Yeah.
And they cannot change from mm-hmm. class to class. I think the description was a student who lost his lunchbox before, mm-hmm. and so they couldn't get ready to take the SOL that needed to be mm-hmm. taken next because he couldn't find his lunchbox and because he has and because that was perseverate and this happens with multiple students on the autistic spectrum and so I found that to be something I was completely unaware of, apparently happens in the public school system. Kids who are highly functioning enough. But I was hearing these stories about some kids who take calculus. Completely high functioning with math, but cannot communicate very well at all in terms of having a conversation or doing their English class but as far as math goes, super, and can tutor or at least help explain other math to other students.
Yeah.
But when the English class comes around, nope, not very well at all.
Yeah, it's interesting. What you're talking about is something that we do talk about in the field often, and it's an inadequacy of this metaphor of the spectrum, right? Because the spectrum suggests that we go from severe straight over to highly functioning, right? It's all kind of one sliding scale. Each, as I think I kind of hinted at before, and as you're talking about right now, each individual kind of mental, psychological, social measure can be kind of dialed in and widely disparate from one individual to the next. So communication skills may be extremely high, but this ability to move quickly from one idea to another may be extremely low, and those individuals are the ones who perseverate or who can have obsessions, would be the way that I would talk about it. People talk all the time about how the spectrum thing doesn't quite do adequate justice to that, and I've seen somebody, one of the parents of one of our students, has played with the idea of a kind of a plot graph, right, that shows different skills at different levels, right, and you can see this kind of zigzag, very individualized, almost fingerprint of capabilities that you might get from one student to the next, because those challenges can change so severely. I know one student at James C. Ormel School who is kind of an astonishingly smart kid who has no verbal language whatsoever. So zero verbal language, but is really, really smart and a fast talker to boot. He uses an assistive tablet that is set up with assistive communication software, and the kid is the fastest talker who doesn't have a word in his vocabulary that I've ever seen, because his hands just fly over that thing. Ask him a question, and he's got the answer for you right away. So this incredibly fine-grained, really particularized set of challenges and abilities is something that characterizes people on the autism spectrum, and it's a thing we're really well set up to deal with in an individualized basis.
The phrase or the description that was given to me when having conversations with others before today's show and doing my homework was, quote, "You've met one kid with autism, you've met one kid with autism." There's no way to you can't put them under an umbrella. There's one doesn't describe another,
Yeah. And we want to make sure that we do a lot to particularize their treatment models. And there's a thing, you talk about public schools, one of the things that the legal structures for public schools and our relationships with our public school partners require of us is an individualized education plan for each student, right, that addresses exactly this thing you're talking about, this fingerprint of both their challenges and of their abilities, because the great lesson of this is that every one of these kids, no matter how challenged in some areas, has other abilities, like I was just talking about. So developing that IEP and making sure that IEP, that individualized education plan, works for the student is something that we and our public school partners work together on, making sure happens for every individual.
Yeah. 37 minutes after the hour with our guest, Larry Gerritsen from the Virginia Institute of Autism. Larry, let's talk a little bit about the history of VIA. We're going to get cut off and we'll come back to it. But I was fascinated to learn it started with four students.
Yeah. So the history of VIA is similar to other organizations around the country that provide the same kinds of services that we do. It was driven by families in need. There were a set of local families who had received a diagnosis, and as is so often the case from people who had their children diagnosed back in the 90s and before, they talked to the developmental pediatrician who did the diagnosis, who gave them a little information sheet and said, good luck. And there was really nothing out there for them. They worked through their local school districts, but at that time, it was only just starting to become widely known what could work against autism. And so these parents went out and beat the bushes and found what could work. And what they discovered was a treatment regime, a scientific approach to education that's called applied behavior analysis. And what that is just an incredibly fine-grained attention to cutting apart every little teaching opportunity into the smallest increment and repeating it and varying it and charting its success. And does it work when one teacher is doing it and not another teacher? Does it work in a certain environment with a number of other individuals around, or does it only work when the child is alone? Isolating variables. It's an incredibly scientifically focused, rigorous effort to do what any good teaching does, which is figure out what works for the child and make sure that you land it. So what these parents found was that this science of applied behavior analysis and this scientific approach to teaching kids with autism was starting to work. There were places in the country, like there was a Princeton Child Development Institute, I believe, where they were pioneering this kind of work back in the 1990s. our parents, who were, you know, these local parents who were just desperate to find what worked, took a field trip up there to learn about this. I've heard stories that these parents were brought textbooks in applied behavior analysis back with them when they founded VIA, and would meet in reading groups in a local bar or coffee house after hours, learning these techniques themselves so they could apply them to their kids. What they started at VIA back in 1996 was an after-school program where they could start to run a few of these kinds of teaching methods on their kids. And at first there were 4 students. And very quickly, within the school year, they found the wherewithal to make it a full-time school with a full-time staff. I believe that full-time staff was a staff of 1 at that point. But it started growing from there, to the point where now, 21 years later, we're serving a few hundred families in 3 different programs. But the moral of that is that, you know, this is autism services are driven by need, right? The stories that you hear from families of what it was like to have a child with autism on the spectrum 20 years ago are kind of harrowing. One of our families tells the story of their child being kind of locked in a room alone, crying all day at school because his teachers did not know how to deal with his tantrums and his disability. The story you hear from our families is one of profound isolation too. People did not know then. We only barely know now what autism is and what its effect is on families. But isolation in a sense of not losing your community, having to stay home because your child's tantrums are too severe, and kind of losing friends and family connections because of that are really pretty common. One of our families tells a really heartbreaking story that, and this didn't happen so long ago. It was within the last 5 or 6 years, I think.
Save that story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're going to use that as a teaser. Come back for that story. Let me take a break. This is Larry Gerritsen, talking about autism. And I'm Rick Moore, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Hang tight. All right, Larry Gerritsen, give us a lead up to your story.
Yeah, so, just talking about how much public understanding there is of autism, and in particular the isolation that autism brings to a sense, the sense of isolation that autism brings to a family. There's a particularly heartbreaking story that one of our families tells. Her son was diagnosed with autism around the same time that one of their neighbors had a child who was diagnosed with cancer. And this family saw the outpouring of support that came streaming in to that family across the street. But got none of that themselves, right? So people know what cancer is, and the sense that the family and community and your friends want to rally around someone and bring the meals by and take the balloons in and sit and be is very well established. But, there's a lack of understanding and a sense of challenge around autism that means that often our families feel like a bell jar has dropped over top of them. And this family felt that really, really strongly. So she talks really, really powerfully about how horrible that was for them to go through. So one of the things that mattered when VIA was founded 20 years ago was that these families felt like they found 2 things. There's one of our founding members, a gentleman who was actually one of the first executive directors of VIA, says that what we had going for us was 2 things. We found the science I talked about just a few minutes ago, applied behavior analysis, but we also found each other. We found a sense of community in our shared purpose and shared attention to finding solutions to this problem for our kids. And that's still a focus that we have at VIA now. We're trying to provide a sense of community, comfort for each other, and also bring the scientifically based treatments that can help move the needle.
Do you think that I know that there's more than one, but do you think TV shows that have high-functioning autistic individuals help by showing the general public what an individual with autism can be like.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think those help or hurt?
I think they help to a limited extent. I think, yeah, anything that raises awareness, anything that puts a human face on this this disorder that is really dehumanizing, right? I mean, what autism does is it erodes human connection, right? I mean, your child, people talk about their child disappearing from them when the symptoms of autism start to come on. Sometimes they come on around age two. So the heartbreak of this is that families see their kids start to develop language, see their kids start to make eye contact, see all those things start, and then they go away. That's a very classic way for the symptoms to develop. The challenges of autism are dehumanizing. So anything like a TV show that characterizes a person with autism and puts a human face on it just helps us live in a more, you know, humane environment for people with autism. But I think I've heard a number of families challenged by autism say that it really doesn't paint the full picture of what autism is. VIA tends to serve the families who are most challenged. So what's not so photogenic and what's not so easy to show in a movie or a TV show is the kid who at age 12 is still not toilet trained, right? Is the kid who has physical outbursts to the point of injuring himself or injuring people around him. We have staff who go to work and put on overalls and put on pads like those used in a sparring match in boxing in order to work with some of the kids that we work with, right? It's not all of them. It's a small subset, but that's a reality of the face of autism that you're not going to see communicated in a TV show or in a movie.
You talk about going away, so let's talk about what you have labeled here as the autism cliff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there are a number of things that we at VIA are really working hard on. And one of those is this the challenge of this big demographic wave that we're talking about. So if 20 years ago, ability to diagnose autism kind of took this leap up, so what does that mean demographically? We've been talking up till now about the services that come through schools, through public schools, and the funding that comes through public schools to fund our school. So what happens when kids reach age 22? That's the legal mandate changes from state to state, but here in Virginia, it's through 21. So when a kid hits age 22, what happens to them? And the answer has been historically not much. And we talk about this as the autism cliff. And as we see this increasing incidence of diagnosis, increasing number of individuals that started to increase about 20 years ago, those kids are reaching their 20s and into their late 20s now. And what do we do with them? It's estimated that nationwide, every 10 years, about 500,000 kids, young adults, reach age 21 and age out of the services that exist in public schools.
Grief.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we don't really know exactly what that number is in statewide. I haven't done the count myself. I think we can probably figure it out and just do the count nationwide. But there are currently, I think the number is 27,000 kids in public schools with an autism diagnosis right now. Eventually, those kids are going to turn to age 21, and what happens? So the ability through insurance to fund autism services is pretty limited. We're changing some of that legally now. There is, through Medicaid, an ability to fund lifelong services through something that's called, for a reason I'm still not quite able to articulate very clearly, it's called the waiver program, the Medicaid waiver program. It exists to fund lifelong services for individuals with developmental disabilities. I'm not sure of the total number who have the Medicaid waiver right now in the state of Virginia, but I know that the waiting list is 15,000 people deep. So there really is almost, there's a huge pit of underfunded young adults and adults with autism, how do we provide those people with services? And we talk about that as the autism cliff, falling off the autism cliff. So the lack of funding for services means that there's not a lot of service providers out there. We run an adult services program, and it provides, we call it our adult academy. It provides life skills training, so independent living training for people with autism. It provides health and wellness, so physical education, keeping them off the couch. And it provides community engagement opportunities, people keeping them engaged in the community through volunteering, through vocational education work as well. But we only serve 16 clients right now, 16. And that's, just a drop in the bucket of what's out there. And it's because the funding doesn't exist. Parents either have to come up with the funding themselves or sit on the waiver wait list until they get Medicaid waiver funding.
Goodness gracious. Larry Gerritsen here, Director of Communications for the Virginia Institute of Autism, overwhelming me with information that I'm not sure that I can... Tolerate is the first word that comes to mind here.
Well, you know, what I'll say is that, the challenges can seem overwhelming. We have a treatment model, though. We know it works. What we need to do is build a future in which funding for these things can increase, in which service providers like us can continue to build the expertise that delivers results. And that we continue to innovate. One of the things we're proudest of is that we're building new programs that can help meet these challenges. So a couple of things that are going on at VIA right now that can help address some of the challenges of the autism cliff are folks at our school, the supervisors and the clinical directors at our school, are developing our vocational training curriculum for kids who are in middle school age and high school age. And what that means is that we'll be able to start developing really fine-grained models for evaluating the skills and abilities and the workplace challenges that kids, as they age into young adulthood, might be meeting, and then finding local businesses who can help us try to find a niche for them. One of our partnerships that we're most excited about and proudest of and most thankful for is Crutchfield has started to place a number of our school students in a volunteering program there where they go by and write thank you notes. Crutchfield is great at delivering personalized service to the people who buy their products. So we have kids who go by and write the thank you notes to the customers that go out in their mailings. And there's a little stamp they put on that said that this thank you is contributed by a student from the Virginia Institute of Autism. So it's a great little kind of cross promotion, awareness builder, also an opportunity for us to find job niches for kids with autism. We're also building that out at the adult level as well. So we've got a great innovative program we're developing right now at our adult program, and we're calling it Viable Ventures. And what we're setting out to do is, even as a nonprofit, to develop for-profit businesses that are keyed specifically to providing gainful employment for people on the autism spectrum, for adults on the autism spectrum. So there are, depending on how you slice the statistics, the employment of adults with autism is really a pretty dire thing, right? It could be anywhere from 15% to 30% of young adults with autism, depending on how you slice the pie, have any kinds of vocational opportunity in their lives whatsoever. And that's a horrible challenge, but we're innovating to meet the challenges. So what Viable Ventures is doing right now is starting a candle making business that allows us to use the skills of people with autism, and that perseverating thing you talked about earlier, the ability to focus and stay hyper-focused on a single task is a thing that we can actually use to the advantage of these individuals sometimes for doing repetitive tasks over long periods of time. So, and making candles is one of those kinds of things. Pouring the wax will be one job. putting in the wicks will be another job. And we got a great staff at the Adult Academy at VIA who's working right now to find markets. We got a few vendors lined up who are eager to buy our candles. And we're going to start making sure that some of our adult clients have a paycheck. That's going to be a real meaningful thing that we're going to be able to deliver to people. So the challenges are pretty severe, but we've got hope, and we've got a very strong, innovative, really highly skilled set of professionals working on the challenges at VIA right now.
That's awesome. 55 minutes after the hour, a few minutes left here with Larry Gerritsen from the Virginia Institute of Autism. Now, Larry, you never know what to believe and what not to believe when you read the internet, but regular articles that you can find on the internet if you Google says there's causes and cures for autism. What should I believe?
Well, we don't have a cure. What we believe is science. VIA's mission is predicated on evidence-based treatment. So you can read a lot. You can find a lot.
Well, I did read where the FDA had given a grant to some company. This is from January of 2018. My notes were minimal, but FDA had given a grant to some company for some pharmaceutical.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are pharmaceutical treatments for symptoms that we know of. As far as I know, there's no pharmaceutical treatment that would serve as a cure. I'm not aware of any movement that's even close to delivering something like that. People hold on to hope, right? And they sometimes grasp for hope, and you find a lot of kind of, frankly, not scientifically valid claims out there for cures and treatments.
It was the internet.
Mm-hmm. And that's the internet is can be a home for that kind of stuff. We hold on to evidence. And what we'll say about any of those things is once science shows us that there is evidence that is a treatment, that is a valid treatment, that a treatment that works, once science shows us that it is something that might approximate a cure, we are all in. Until then, we'll stick with what works, and that's what we focus on at VIA. Yeah.
So we have about a minute and a half left. There's all sorts of information that we didn't get to about government and funding, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But speaking about funding, what do people need to know about VIA and the funding that VIA needs and how to reach out to you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we talked about some of the funding, right, that it comes through public schools and that there's this adult services lifetime support for developmental disabilities that is not adequately funded at all. VIA is also a nonprofit, and we do fundraising that helps to supplement all of those things and add extra value and extra impact and extra reach and extra capacity, right, because our public funding sources are, I think, you know, if there's one upshot from what we've talked about here, our public funding sources are not going to meet the need. So VIA is actively fundraising all the time. You may have run into some of our fundraising locally. We've done it traditionally through a couple of big events. A Run for Autism 5K every April, we just had it last month, raises over $100,000 every year to augment our services. Our gala raises a few $100,000 every year to augment our services as well. We need to do a lot more of that, and it's a thing we're focused on as we build capacity to serve, as we build our expertise, as we build our innovative programs. We're fundraising all the time, so please come and visit us at www.viaschool.org to find out more about what we do. Send us a contribution, and you're going to help the cause, help make for a more humane and inclusive community for us all to live in.
Well, I look forward to the day when the internet is true with its article on New York Times about causes and cures. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
All right. Next week, the ladies from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library will be here to talk about your books to read for the summer. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy your day.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice from Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.